The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 19, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning, everyone. Just a few things before we get started here. First of all, for whom this might apply, happy Father's Day. And also, if you're living in this stretch of the country where the temperatures are going to soar near 100 degrees, please take care of yourself today. That'd be kind of a hot day. So, and then finally, some of you may have been thinking that Norm Randolph is going to give the talk today. So if you came expecting that, my apologies. Norm is unable to attend today, and so I will be I won't be taking his place. Nobody can take Norm's place, but I'll be giving the talk today instead. I hope that's not too grave a disappointment. But you know what I thought I would do is, since Norm can't make it, I can at least bring Norm into the room in some way. So I thought I would read and make comments on an article that Norm had written for the Dharma Field newsletter a number of years ago. And for those of you who are familiar with Norm's talks, this is going to sound familiar. The article is titled, You Are Buddha. So I want to talk about Norm's article, You Are Buddha. It's a very rich article, very foundational teaching. And I just feel like bringing that teaching up. Norm's here in spirit anyhow. So, and he should be able to join us next week. So what I'm going to do is I'll just kind of read through Norm's essay, and then I'll make comments as I go along. Throughout his teaching career, Katagiri Roshi taught, you are Buddha. All beings are Buddha. At first, no one understood, but eventually a few people did. At his last Dharma talk, before he died of cancer, he was very weak and had to be helped to sit down on his cushion. But when he spoke, he gave a very powerful lecture. He knew it was his last talk, so he gave it everything he had. And in this talk, he very strongly emphasized, you are Buddha. And, you know, I think the importance of a teaching like this, the reason we need to be reminded that we are Buddha, is because of the strong beliefs that we hold about the nature of reality. And those beliefs, they're beliefs. Right? They're ideas we have about what reality is, and then we put our trust in our beliefs about how reality is. And in doing so, we overlook what's actually taking place. So then we have a teacher like Katagiri reminding us, you are Buddha. And the deal about those beliefs, what makes them so, I guess, difficult. I want to use the word insidious, but that sounds like there's some craftiness involved, and that's not it at all. But what makes them difficult for us, how it is that we get caught up in our beliefs and overlook what's actually taking place, is that they're often just assumptions that we make. So they're not something that we're saying, well, this is what I believe. We can imagine beliefs like that we hold much more consciously and say, this is what I believe. I believe this about this other thing. But some beliefs, and in particular, the beliefs that we hold about the nature of reality, are assumptions that show up almost as soon as we enter a room or we see something. Something shows up, and as soon as we take it to be that something that's out there popping up in front of us, a whole world comes along with it. A whole world of assumptions come along with it. And then we look at that whole world of assumptions that arise with what is showing up before us, and we take that to be the nature of reality. And in that way, we overlook what is actually taking place. We overlook the fact that we are Buddha. So if it may sound at first where you go, well, if I'm Buddha, why do I need somebody to tell me that? It's because of how easily we get caught up. And this getting caught up every time an object appears before us, and that object can be anything. It can be a thought, it can be an emotion, it can be a sound, it can be something in our visual frame, it can be a touch, a taste, whatever it is, those objects are so compelling that it shows up, boom, we're sucked in. And we're overlooking what's actually taking place. So Norm continues. He says, the great Zen master Suzuki Roshi, who founded the San Francisco Zen Center, also pointed this out, that is, you are Buddha. He would say to his students, when I look at you, I see you all as perfect Buddhas. However, he would go on to say, I see you all as perfect Buddhas until you open your mouths to say something. And, you know, it's a funny teaching. Suzuki had a nice light touch where there could be some laughter in the insights that he's pointing out. And what's great about that, you know, until you open your mouths to say something, is that it really gets to the heart of the matter. We may think, okay, so what? So I get the nature of reality wrong. It sounds kind of abstract to people sometimes, and they think, whatever that might mean. And I think people have ideas about what that might mean. But when we get caught up in our ideas about what reality is, when we get caught up in our conceptualizing of what's showing up, we speak and act out of that conceptualization. And a Zen master like Suzuki, he could hear that. So students would just start talking, and in what they were saying and in what they were doing, they were revealing how it is that they took this reality to be, how it is that they understand what it is that's taking place. We're reading Charlotte Joko Beck in a study group on Thursday mornings, and she talks about the way that we usually go about our life as being self-centered. And we might have ideas about what self-centered means. You know, so somebody who's self-centered usually elbows are out, and it's all about me, 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 me. But I think Joko Beck, while it includes that and can lead to that kind of behavior, is just talking about actions or behaviors that come from the self. When we see those objects that appear before us, a self always shows up. There's always a subject and an object that appears to be very real for us. And in that way of seeing the world, that subject that shows up, we think, okay, I'm the person who's experiencing this. Now I'm the king. This is my reality. And so we act in ways that just come from this idea of self and an idea of a world out there. So you can imagine, you know, if things are going well, maybe that me that's having a good time tries to figure out how to make that last a little bit longer. And maybe you can make it last a little bit longer. Or maybe in doing that, suddenly everybody's unhappy. For some reason, I'm picturing crying children and somebody trying to, come on, this is fun. Let's have a good time here. You know, so that self-centered action can just show up in how we're behaving and what we're doing. Maybe something shows up, we don't like it. And so we're scrambling to try to make things better. And in doing so, make a worse mess of it. Or you think about Oedipus Rex, you know, who has the prophecy. Well, actually, he didn't have anything to do with what happened to him. But the prophecy was that he was going to sleep with his mother and kill his father, basically. Basically, he would kill the king. So they got rid of him. That didn't matter. It just tightened the noose up, you know. So this self-centered behavior shows up. Our self-centered thoughts show up. And also, when we think of reality as a subjective, objective experience, where there's a subject that's experiencing an objective world that's out there, then we think that that objective world is something that we can intellectually know, something that we can get data on, and then in getting that data, that we can know it. So I don't know if Suzuki, when he was saying, I see you all as perfect Buddhas until you open your mouth to say something, right? In one way, it reveals that self-centeredness, but it can also reveal that sense that you got it, that you can actually tell people what the truth is. And if you've ever tried to speak the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, you know that it's very difficult. I throw that little judicial language, the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Because, you know, if somebody were to ask me that, I'd be a little afraid because I don't know if I could do that. And I think people get tripped up, you know, in the witness stands because of that. And in fact, I had a professor in graduate school once who was an expert witness at the obscenity trial for Allen Ginsberg's poem Howl. And my professor had to do is get up and testify that Howl was in an avant-garde tradition that went back to Dada, if not before that. That's all his job was. He was an expert in avant-garde poetics. But he got caught up on the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, to help you God. And he goes, I don't know what that means, but I'm going to try to tell it. And he started to say too much, and his lawyer just cut him off. Thank you, Mr. Blau, and it dismissed him. So we think when we have this idea of an objective reality that we can say it, that we can say it all. And of course we can't, which doesn't mean we don't say anything or we don't try to point back to reality, to the nature of this reality, but just that we have an awareness that we can't say it, and usually we don't. So whatever it was Suzuki was hearing his students say, and I'm sure it was a mix of self-centered and here's how things are. So Buddha is the reality of awakeness, which is the true self, the true life, the true nature of each being. It is the subjectless, objectless awakeness, which is being directly experienced by all beings now. The historical Buddha, who lived in India approximately 2,500 years ago, was a person who profoundly realized the reality of awakeness. He clearly saw that this reality was his true self. He realized that the seemingly separate individual that he seemed to be was an empty, illusory manifestation of the true self, or Buddha. He realized this was true for all seemingly separate beings and phenomena in the universe. The reality of awakeness, or Buddha, is the boundless, all-inclusive reality of here and now. Different terms are used to point to this reality: totality, wholeness, the universe, Dharma, truth, thusness, the true self, supreme enlightenment, the one Buddha mind, and other terms as well. And if you take up this practice, you know there are lots of other terms as well. And they're all pointing back to the same thing. So when we usually perceive our reality, or the way that we usually understand a reality, is having a subject and an object. You see, Norm points out that the nature of reality, the reality of awakeness, is subjectless objectlessness. A lot of lessnesses in there. Now we can see that we're overlooking reality if we're taking it, our experience as being subject and object. This is happening to me. I'm seeing this. I'm hearing this. I'm doing that. If we can't conceive of experience without subject, how can there be experience without somebody experiencing it? And yet, as Norm points out in his essay, this subjectless, objectless awakeness is being directly experienced by all beings now. So it just sounds so, you know, the idea that there'd be a experience that's subjectless, objectless, it just sounds so elusive and so far out, in a manner of speaking, like far out, you know, it just doesn't seem like what it is that's going on. But as Norm assures us, this is what's being experienced right now. Right now. And in fact, Norm will use this term, here and now reality, because this is what's taking place right here, right now. And that here we're talking about is not here as opposed to there, the way, again, we usually conceive the world. This here instead is the realization that, to put it sort of, to paraphrase the way that it's put in the cult 1980s film, Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, no matter where you go, here you are. In that movie, the guy says, no matter where you go, there you are. And I remember when I was 18 years old, that seemed both funny and kind of profound at the same time. But it's no matter where you go, here you are. Because you can go ahead and get in your car and drive 100 miles away, and you're still going to see that as being here. You know? Now you'll see that where you're not, you'll call that there. That's not the here we're talking about. It's just here, always here. That's the way reality is showing up. It's showing up here. It's showing up now. And again, that now is not opposed to then. That now is not a time. I think I've spoken about this before in talks, but At one point when I was in graduate school, I started thinking a little bit about time and experience, not in any philosophical way because I'm not that smart, but it just happened to be what I was writing about. And it just started to get me to think that whenever I thought, well, I'm talking about now, it was already wrong. Right? If you say now, then the thing you were calling now is already past. Even articulating it means you're lagging behind the actual experience. And so I was convinced in graduate school there was no now. There couldn't be now because I couldn't locate it. And every time I tried to say, well, here it is right now, it seemed to be gone. And I was like, well, there's always that past that this thing seems to be receding, and that's there for sure. I was convinced of that. And then there's the stuff coming up, the future. I was convinced of that as well. In the meantime, overlooking what's actually taking place is right here, right now. That is the nature of our experience. And it's boundless. It has no beginning. And you can't, if you just pay attention to it, where did it begin? Where is the beginning? Where is the ending? It's always now, here now. This is the nature of awakeness, the nature of the reality of awakeness. So this reality of awakeness is sometimes described as being wondrous and inconceivable. It is described in this way because it cannot be objectified or conceptually grasped. No matter how much we speak about it or write about it, it cannot be pinned down or objectified or explained or packaged into conceptual description. Nevertheless, it is clear and obvious. It is being directly experienced now, and everything is a manifestation of it. It cannot be hidden. Dharma teaching is pointing to this reality of awakeness, which cannot be explained or objectified, and yet which cannot be hidden. This reality of awakeness or Buddha, which is clear and obvious, is usually ignored or overlooked. It is ignored by getting caught up in the belief in separation of self and other, and the belief in a dualistically structured reality. Reality is ignored when we are caught up in these beliefs and respond and act based on these beliefs. We are profoundly taken in by these beliefs in many ways. We have many beliefs or assumptions about ourselves, others, and the nature of reality, and we live our lives based on these beliefs. This is the ignorance by which our Buddhahood is ignored. So first, you know, Norm points out this reality of awakeness is sometimes described as being wondrous and inconceivable. And we take these words then to mean something like, again, you know, I'm talking about far out. I know I'm using sort of old hippie language there, you know, but in a way that far out is talking about something that is just completely removed from normal everyday experience. It is far out, you know, it's far out man, you know, it's far out. And so we hear those terms, wondrous and inconceivable, and it sounds like we're talking about some amazing, like I said, far out experience, like something, I don't know if something's going to like, well, this is the way I thought of it. The way we might be conceiving it is like the Wizard of Oz, you know, where Dorothy starts out and she living her life in drab Kansas and it's filmed in black and white. And then she gets to Oz, and when she opens that door up, that's got to be one of the great, in my opinion, one of the great images of cinema, when Dorothy opens the door up to Oz and everything's been black and white up to that point. All that color, that 1930s Technicolor that looks like, I don't know why, you know, it's just so vibrant with color. And she steps through it into this rich polychromatic world from this monochromatic world of Kansas. And I think that's what people think. Oh, that's what we're talking about. It's suddenly going to look like that. It's going to be something special. You know, when I was a kid, I couldn't stand the black and white is the wrong way to put it. So I'm talking about 3 years old. I just know that when it was black and white, it was in my mind not interesting. But I knew there was going to be this moment where she steps through this door and there's going to be all this color. And that was the exciting part. And when we start thinking in terms of wondrous and inconceivable as being something that's far out, something that's not really what's being experienced right now, we miss out on what's going on right now. Now I can watch those black and white scenes, and I think they're beautifully photographed. beautiful black and white photography. You know, and when that tornado comes, I don't know if you've ever seen the tornado, but it's a little model made with nylons. You know, it shouldn't look as cool as it does, but the whole thing looks cool. So we can start to realize that there's beauty in the stuff that we overlook, that we think of as the mundane. If we don't think of wondrous and inconceivable as being somehow far out to us, it's not far out to us. It's not something we're not already experiencing. Remember, Norm points out in this essay that this experience of reality is clear and obvious. And this is a refrain that comes up in the teachings and our precepts. Reality, true nature, the way we word it in our precepts, true nature is clear and obvious. Another way to put that clear and obvious nature, because we might hear something like this and say, oh, it's not clear and obvious. Like, clearly I'm getting caught up in my preconceived ideas. Clearly I'm getting caught up in my conceptions about the world. Clearly I'm overlooking my Buddhahood. And that's why somebody like Katagiri has to remind me over and over and over why Norm reminds us time and again, you are Buddha. So reality can't be that clear and obvious. But here it is, you know. Another way to think about clear and obvious is a way that Suzuki Roshi put it, which is nothing special. There's nothing special about this wondrous and inconceivable reality. It's just what's showing up right now. If we make something special out of it, then it becomes something we don't have right now that we want to have. And it's not here anymore. Then the thing we don't have is far out. It seems to be beyond our reach, and we're going to need to, I don't know, be in a house that gets caught up in a tornado to fling us into the place where the technicolor is. And you can see what's going on there. You know, this is belief in separation between me and enlightenment. And enlightenment then is separated from us, and it becomes something that's unattainable. But if we really just pay attention to what's going on, if we can really settle into this moment, here we are. Here's that Buddha nature, that true self that we think we need to go looking for. Norm continues. He says, we don't try to get rid of beliefs. We don't try to get rid of the ignoring or ignorance. We don't try to get rid of the emotional responses, desires, and patterns of behavior based on this ignorance. Instead, we are just aware of them. Eventually, these could be seen as empty, illusory manifestations of the true self or Buddha. Then they cease to be problems. Then they can be seen as helpful pointers, showing us how we are interpreting reality, how we are responding to it, how we are getting stuck, and how we can be released. In this practice of awakeness, the ways in which the true self is ignored can eventually be seen through, and they drop away by themselves. And this is very important. We don't try to get rid of our beliefs. And it will sound to us like that's what we need to do. Here we are, we have these beliefs, and those beliefs seem to be getting in the way of our experience of our true self, the true nature of reality. Well, don't you want to get rid of those beliefs then? Really, what's happening with those beliefs, the beliefs are arising. What we do, though, is we put our faith in our beliefs. We put our trust in the beliefs that they are ultimately true. That's the thing we can watch what we're doing, right? So we don't get rid of how reality is showing up. Remember what Norm points out in this essay. Anything that shows up is manifestation of totality, of this Buddha nature, of thusness. That's the nature of everything that appears is really that. And what we do is we lose track of that. Again, we get caught up in the thingness of what it is that's showing up. But so then we don't try to get rid of anything, because how can you? If what's showing up is an expression of totality, well, how do you get rid of that? How do you get rid of totality? You can't. Once you get rid of that, if you could get rid of it, now you've reduced totality. And how can you do that? That wouldn't be a totality anymore. It'd be totality minus that thing that you've gotten rid of. So we don't get rid of the ignorance. We don't get rid of our beliefs. We don't get rid of our emotional responses. We see them. We see them for what they are, which is just something that's showing up temporarily, don't go away. As Norm points out, these things drop away by themselves. They drop away by themselves no matter what we do. And we can get totally caught up in trying to get rid of them ourselves. And I think a lot of us do. There, maybe we engage in some behavior that we want to change, and so we work really hard at doing it. Meanwhile, reality is just whatever the problem was, it's probably subsiding. We're creating new problems, perhaps, in the way that we're addressing it, as I've said before. So we're not trying to get rid of these beliefs. We're not trying to get rid of these responses. We're just seeing that they're there. That's how reality is showing up. And see if we can not do something with that, not take it for being something realer than it is. And there is a reality to it, as Norm's going to get to in his essay. So I don't want to point out, or I don't want to suggest that reality is not showing up this way, and that this way that it's showing up doesn't have rules to it. It does, but those rules are contingent, and they're continually being negotiated. Suzuki Roshi used to say, "Since you are Buddha, you must be Buddha. That is our practice." In a lecture he gave at the monastery at Tassajara in July 1968, he said, "When it is hot, you should be hot Buddha. When it is cold, you should be cold Buddha." So first we have this instruction, since you are Buddha, you must be Buddha. And I was thinking about the way that could be inflected, to kind of point toward the nature of what it is that we're doing when we show up here. First of all, I think you can hear it as, since you are Buddha, you must be Buddha. You know, somebody have met you, maybe they've heard about, this is going back to the 70s a little bit, but the television show Columbo, the main character, Detective Columbo, he would always refer to his wife, always talk about Mrs. Columbo. And she never appeared on the show. She eventually got her own show, which wasn't so good. But anyhow, she was always off camera. And you could imagine, he would talk about his wife all the time. That if he were to walk into a room with a woman who looked like she conceivably could be Detective Columbo's wife, somebody would go, "Oh, you must be Mrs. Columbo." And you know, that's why I think, "Oh, you must be Buddha. Since you are Buddha, you must be Buddha." Of course, that's the way it actually is. That's who you are. Well, you must be Buddha. You can say that to everybody. Well, you may want to watch that. Some people probably don't want to hear you say that, and other people think you're crazy. But that's what it is. You must be Buddha. You know, so there's that way, that whenever you meet somebody, you must be Buddha, because that's true. That is, that person is Buddha showing up as that person. The other way, of course, is, well, if that's the case, why are we sitting this practice, right? Since you are Buddha, you must be Buddha. That, if we have a purpose in life, is what our purpose in life is to be our true self, is to wake up to that. That's it. It can't really be any other way. To be your true self. That's, you know, if you were to say why we're here, but I wouldn't even go that far. But that's what we're doing here, just being our true self. And so in that case, we can hear Suzuki saying, first of all, well, you must be Buddha. And then you must be Buddha. Since you are Buddha, that's what it is that we're doing here. And when we find ourselves getting lost, when we get caught up in suffering, we're losing track of the Buddha that we are. We're not realizing that Buddha. We're not realizing that by necessity, that's what we are. We're Buddha. We don't realize that we're struggling and suffering, that we're already our true self. Even in that struggling and ignoring of reality, we are that true self. So when it is hot, Suzuki tells us, be hot Buddha. So one great thing about this teaching, you know, when it's hot, be hot Buddha. When it's cold, be cold Buddha. There's so many days in the year that this applies to Minnesota. It seems like it's either too hot or too cold. And there's a kind of a character to Minnesotans. I don't know how many of you on Zoom land who aren't from Minnesota, if you've been to Minnesota and maybe you've had a conversation like this, but Minnesotans seem to do two things: complain about how hot it is, complain about how cold it is. You know, and it gets really hot here. Like today, as I said, it's going to get up to 100 degrees. And I don't know, you know, there's a little truism that always goes with that. Minnesotans know it. It's not the heat, it's the humidity. So I don't know if it's going to be humid today, but I'm guessing there's going to be some of that there. And then we, you know, we kvetch about that. We complain about the heat that's showing up. And then the cold, you know, it gets into the minus tens, like multiple minus tens sometimes. It gets really cold here, really cold. I think I've mentioned this before, but I had a friend who moved here from Buffalo. Well, I actually met her in graduate school. So she lived in Milwaukee. Milwaukee is similar temperature, similar kind of climate that Milwaukee is similar climate to Minneapolis. But it's not exactly the same because Milwaukee is on Lake Michigan, and those lakes really do kind of control the climate a little bit. So she moved here from Milwaukee, and she was like, yeah, you know, I love the Twin Cities, but I can't believe the weather is crazy. She goes, you know, if you go from the hottest point in the summer, you know, 90s to 100, this, you know, again, today was supposed to get close to 100, and you get to the coldest days and you're talking like minus 20, minus 30. She's going, that's a 120 degree difference. It's like really crazy. So we know the extremes and we get caught up in them. You know, I think there's a playfulness for Minnesotans to complain about the weather. That's just something to talk about. It's how it's showing up. But at least I know that if I give a talk and it's got this teaching in it, that I'm pretty good to go. There's probably either too hot or too cold here. But what we can realize is that when we're complaining about that weather, yeah, okay, like I said, it can be kind of a game to play, just to talk to somebody and go, oh, is it hot? You know, everybody likes to suffer together rather than alone. But you can also just see that complaint is wanting it to be some other way. Again, very natural thing. If it's too hot or too cold, why not? Why, you know, if that's what you want it to be some other way, want it to be some other way. But just notice that's what's showing up right there. And then we can be much more playful with the way we respond to that. But what Suzuki's pointing out to us is, you know, when it's hot, just be hot Buddha. In other words, be the hotness that reality is showing up as. Let that completely consume your experience. Then there's no your experience. Just let that be experience. And you're going to find out that the experience of it changes pretty radically in character from, you know, that, I'm so hot, you know, that kind of thing, to just being with it. Harder to do. I mean, it is hard to do when the flame is turned up. You just want to go running, screaming. I don't know if you want to do that, but I did at a play I was at once. It was in Milwaukee, and it was a 90 plus degree humid day. And there was an indoor theater piece, and it was performed in a non-traditional theater space. It was like an old storefront, narrow. All the lighting. So the performers actually performed in a space that the audience was sitting around. And then all the lighting equipment. And anyone who's ever been under stage lights knows that's like having like a cooker lamp on you, you know, like a heat lamp. And there's lots of it. So all these hot lights, 90 plus degree, humid day with people. It was a sold out show with people just right next to one another. And I'm sitting there and the rows are really long. I'm only stressing this because I just want to make sure you know that I know that this can really suck. You know, there's no way out of this except for me to knock the person sitting in front of me out of the way so I can jump on stage and get out of there. But I'm sitting there and I'm getting really hot and I can feel sweat trickling down my back. And I was like going, I've got to scream. So I know that can really call our attention. Our suffering really catches us up. We can see that that's what we're doing. And we don't have to. Guess what? I didn't scream. I didn't go out. I didn't sit and dwell on that sweat and that hotness. I didn't dwell on that the entire 2 hours of the play. You know, I got through it. And how do we? Because this is the nature of reality. We think we're not going to get through that. And then conditions change. And that discomfort that looked like it was never going to end just takes care of itself. I didn't have to knock anybody down. I didn't have to step on the stage. I didn't have to run out of the building. But it was still 90 plus degrees. It was still humid, you know. So when it is hot, you should be hot. Just be the experience. Don't make yourself separate from it and at odds with it. Suzuki went on to say that each individual, each thing, each event, each situation, each experience is Buddha. Each thought, each feeling, each emotion, each desire, each perception, each state of consciousness is Buddha. When you realize that you are Buddha and understand everything is an unfolding of the truth, then whatever you experience is the actual teaching of Buddha, and whatever you do is the actual practice of Buddha. So I think those are very well put. Whatever you experience, that is whatever you experience is the actual teaching of Buddha. And whatever you do is the actual practice of Buddha. And we hear a teaching like that, and I think it can bum some people out. Whatever you do, that's the actual practice of Buddha. You mean when I trip on the sidewalk, that's the actual practice of Buddha? Or when I lose my temper and start yelling at somebody, that's the actual practice of Buddha? Well, that seems like kind of a bummer. I've heard this expressed. I'll come back to it. No, maybe I'm not going to come back to it. You know, I was talking to somebody else about this recently, and then it came up. Totally different person brought this up. You know the Peggy Lee song, Is That All There Is? I don't know if you don't know it. This narrator of the song just starts like kind of going through a litany of just how horrible life is. She's just telling you all these bad things that have happened. And then she asks in the chorus, is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friend, then let's keep dancing. So at least she's got a happy ending to that. But it's this resignation she's got, like, this is it. Oh my God, well, we might as well get drunk and have a good time, you know? And that is a response people will often have. When they hear something like this, they're like, this is it? My suffering? You mean I have to sit there and sit in this squalor of my life? This misery that I might be going through right now? This dissatisfaction? That's it? That's all there is? Well, if that's the way you're looking at it right now, yeah, that's all there is. That's it, baby. You know, so you can see that that's how you're constructing your world. You can see that that's not really what's going on. What's going on is completely divorced from how you're interpreting it, except that it's expressing itself as how you're interpreting it. You can see that that's what's going on. Bit of trivia, just going to toss it in there and I'll move on. But I was looking, when I was hearing that Peggy Lee song probably about a year ago or so, I was looking at the credits on the record sleeve. First of all, I wanted to know who wrote such a depressing song. But I saw that the orchestrator, the arranger of that single is Randy Newman. So at least I know one other song I'm a member will be impressed by that. But anyhow, so if we construct our world that way, if we get caught up in our construction, our conceptual constructions, and we start going positive, negative, the way this is showing up, too hot, negative, too cold, negative. Well, yeah, then your experience is going to, you tell somebody, well, that's Buddha showing up that way. You'd be like, oh, what a bummer. Well, just notice that all of that, again, is just this conceptualization, this way of constructing reality, interpreting it and judging it. We don't have to do that. We can see when that stuff shows up and just go, yeah, that's conceptual construction. And just notice what is actually taking place. Then on the other hand, people can take, you know, anything that you experience as Buddha and they can make something ecstatic out of it. You know, everything you experience is Buddha, you know, and just start getting crazy about it. Remember, this practice is the middle way. As Suzuki says, nothing special. When you add that ecstasy to it, it's like you're adding something extra to it. It's not that you can't feel joyous or you can't feel sad. That's nothing extra. That's how reality is showing up. But it's when you say, oh, everything is Buddha equals, you know, sparklers and fireworks, you know, then you're adding that to the experience and no need to do that. Usually people practice for a long time believing that it is a separate ego self who is carrying out this practice. With continued practice, with help from a teacher, this belief can eventually be seen through. People usually begin practice with the belief that after a long time, they will eventually attain enlightenment. But supreme enlightenment, or Buddha, is being directly experienced now. It is not a matter of practicing for a long time and eventually attaining enlightenment. Most people starting out in this practice believe that practice is a means to attain enlightenment. They believe practice and enlightenment have a dualistic before and after means and ends relationship. But with continued practice, this belief can eventually be seen through. It becomes clear that enlightenment, Buddha, or truth is what we are, and that practice and enlightenment are one. So again, you know, you look and it says that a lot of people when they start this practice, they start with the belief that, you know, after a long time of this practice, they're eventually going to attain enlightenment. That there's a relationship between taking up this practice and attaining enlightenment. Now remember, if that's how you're starting your practice, that's fine. We all have to start someplace. So we come to this practice usually with some idea about what it is that the practice is and maybe why it is that we're coming to this practice. I know I mentioned that I came here because a therapist said, oh, you're suffering from anxiety. You should take up meditation. So my meditation practice was intended to be relief from anxiety. And then I learned that it really wasn't going to do that at all. As I was struggling with my sitting position, I was going to retreats and going, what am I doing? What is this stuff? You know, that's not exactly what the practice is. It's not to do that. But we start someplace. So we might even hear the teacher saying, like I did when I started this practice, you know, they might say something like, oh, Zazen is good for nothing, or your meditation practice is useless. And then people hear that and they go, actually, they really go. I'm going to say they go, oh, why am I doing this? That does arise. But often, because I think I did something like this, you go, yeah, I know. But if it really was useless or really wasn't good for anything, then why are they still doing it? You know, there must be something here. So I know that's just a thing they're saying right now because I don't really understand what's going on. And there's some truth there. Right? Just keep looking at that. Keep investigating that. You know, don't let that go. But anyhow, I just want to say it's okay for us. You know, okay is probably not even the right word. I'm making it sound like, well, I'm giving you permission to have some idea about what this practice is. It's just what shows up. You know, everything is okay in a manner of speaking. Everything is what's showing up. But if you hang on to that idea about practice, your practice will be unsustainable because you're going to be carrying the heavy weight of that expectation with you. And as practice doesn't quite do what you're expecting, that weight, which might have started out as a 5-pound thing, becomes heavier and heavier the longer you carry it and you see no end in sight. So just keep that in mind. These expectations we have them. That's okay. But if you keep carrying those, it will make practice seem impossible and unendurable. That's what's impossible, unendurable, is carrying that weight. It's not practice itself. Practice is just being here. It's not so hard. Already here, right? So it's just realizing the here-now reality that's already here. Some questions might arise, such as who practices, who eventually sees, what is eventually seen, and how long is eventually. These are interesting questions, but don't try to figure out or conceptually grasp particular answers. Whatever concepts or beliefs we have about reality are just limited views. It is by holding to these beliefs and limited views about reality that the actual reality, Buddha, is overlooked. So just live a life of wide open awakeness and curiosity as if we are discovering who we are and what our experience is for the first time. Just be awake to directly experience reality now. Just be awake to directly experience reality now without being taken in by beliefs and limited views. If we believe there is a separate self who practices and eventually sees, and there is a separate reality that is eventually seen, then the directly experienced true self or Buddha is being ignored. So again, sort of points back to what I was just talking about, but he adds a new wrinkle in there, which is this idea of these questions that arise for us and the fact that we want answers. As he says, interesting questions. Can we keep those questions alive rather than rush toward an answer? That's what we usually do, is come up with a conceptual answer to the questions that arise for us. And when we're talking about these kinds of questions, conceptual answers aren't going to help us. In fact, what they do is we think, if we believe that there are conceptual ways of understanding the world, that the more of these ideas we get, the clearer understanding we have of the world, then you can see that we actually are carrying this stuff around with us again. And we're interpreting the world through the concepts that we've accrued over the course of our life. In other words, we're kind of going, I've learned this, I've learned that, I've learned the other thing, and now I'm going to apply this to life. And what Norm is pointing out to us is that, that's not living a life, or how does he put it? He says to experience who we are and what our experience is as if for the first time. That's what Suzuki calls beginner's mind. To see that each moment is in a way refreshed, that no two moments are exactly the same. When we're talking about this relative reality that's showing up, it's continually changing. We're always, there's that part that's not changing, which is awareness of what's taking place. It's experience itself. But the scenery of that continually changes for us. And we can encounter that anew with each moment and not try to impose on what's showing up the ideas that we think we've learned, the truths we think we've learned over the years. The true self manifests itself in such a way as to bring about the appearance of separation of self and others and the appearance of duration and time and extension in space. There seem to be separate beings, times, places, and events to which names, labels, personal pronouns, and conceptual categories can be applied. In accordance with how things appear to be, and in accordance with conventional speech, we use names, labels, personal pronouns, and conceptual categories. We need to function and communicate in the conventional, seemingly dualistic world where there seems to be separation of self and others without being taken in by the belief that there actually is this separation. Then we can be truly helpful to ourselves and all the seemingly separate beings that we meet. So what Norm is stressing here is just with beliefs, we don't get rid of conceptualization. So sometimes people will hear that. We talk about conceptualization, the stuff that we get confused in, these beliefs that we have are conceptualizations of our experience. We think, oh, I got to get rid of conceptualization. But we don't do that. Again, we don't really get rid of anything. It's totality expressing itself thusly. We just don't get caught up in the conceptions that we have. We don't take them to be the truth. We understand that truth, ultimately, truth reality is just this direct experience. And we have a teaching. We recite this at meals during sessions or during our meditation retreats here at Dharma Field. It's in this world of emptiness, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. And that's our practice. We're here in this muddy water, but this muddy water is empty. And can we be in this world of muddy water with purity like a lotus? So we don't try to push away conceptualization. We just understand it for what it is. In this practice of awakeness, it can eventually be seen that all beings are mutually assisting each other. These are not separate beings. If they actually were separate beings, this life of mutual assistance would not be possible. When this is clearly seen, a life of compassion, joy, and fearlessness opens up to us, and we can live as the great Buddhas that we are. So we can see that the way we usually separate everybody out, see ourselves as separate from other people, and everybody's separate from each other, and all things are separate from each other, we can instead see that these seemingly separate things are actually mutually assisting one another. And again, this is one of those teachings that befuddles people, and they think they might point to, say, the war in Ukraine or some big atrocity or some, you know, horror and point to that and go, how is that mutually assisting? But without that there, this as it's showing up here, remember it's here, this right now is showing up. It's mutually assisted by whatever it is that you're going to point to. That is actually reality just showing up right now, right here. Your experience right here, right now, includes all things that you can imagine even. That's just the nature of reality. It's what Thich Nhat Hanh calls inter-are. We inter-are. There's no separation. We can see that. It's once we start trying to peel those things apart or pull those things apart, we realize you can't do it. It's like trying to remove a piece of totality and then say you still have totality. That would be totality minus that thing. And this is where I think people trip up sometimes if your life is comfortable. But maybe the comfortable life you have is predicated, you don't even know it, on the suffering of others. The suffering of others are right here in your comfortable life. It's something to be aware of, something for us to notice. So we know that this world is mutually assisting. And that includes that I that seems to be appearing. We are too. So when we act in this world, what are we doing? Knowing that we are inextricably connected to all beings. And this is what Norm's pointing out to me. This is where we can be the Buddha we are. Huh? You are Buddha, you must be Buddha. When we clearly see the interpenetration of all beings, then Norm points out to us, when we clearly see this, a life of compassion, joy, and fearlessness opens up to us, and we can live as the great Buddhas that we are. All right, now I know how Norm's talks get to be an hour long. You get to talking about this article. So we're almost at the end of the hour, but we do have a couple minutes if people have questions or comments they would like to share. Thank you, Norm, for that teaching, and thank you all for being here today.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.